I have been reading with rapt fascination the new biography by Ron Chernow, who's an old friend and has done some other major biographies of significant Americans. But now he's done what is, up to now, as I think I said a moment ago, his masterwork, though he'll probably top that with something else to appear about 5 years from now. This new book on Alexander Hamilton intrigues me from its very beginning. This rather strange life down there in some odd Caribbean islands, a very inauspicious beginning for a significant life.
I know. It starts out the story in this kind of very dark, murky, mysterious way, because Hamilton is the only founder who's not born in the United States. He's illegitimate. He's orphaned. His father abandons the family when Alexander's 11. Then his mother dies when he's 13.
And there's even a question, isn't there, as to whether his father, Hamilton, the fourth son of a Scottish laird, was actually his father.
This is layer upon layer of mystery. I'm still in the process, even though the book has come out, of running genetic tests on some of the descendants to try to figure out whether, in fact, James Hamilton was what we would call the biological father. So even the father who abandoned him may not have been
Well, you have
the
to do some, you
biological
have to do
father.
some grave digging or exhuming, don't you, to get samples?
Well, it's a complicated process because you get a genetic profile of other Scottish Hamiltons, and then you see whether the genetic profile of the descendants matches it. I won't bore the listeners with all of that.
There's nothing boring about his life, but it
Yeah.
is a life lived at a very grubby and uncomfortable level in the early years, and we won't spend much time on it now, except it's a wonder that if you just kind of look at the chronology, he's working now for a firm still down there in St. Croix,
That's right.
he's had no college education. He's had virtually no education in formal terms of formal schooling, and that's when he's about 17. 3, 4 years later, he's an adjutant to General George Washington.
Washington, yeah. I mean, this gives new meaning to the term meteoric. This is like a
Doesn't it?
guy who shot out of a cannon. And the local merchants in St. Croix, you know, recognize that this impoverished, illegitimate clerk working in this trading house is this prodigy. They take up a fund to educate him in North America. And even when he's an undergraduate at King's College, later renamed Columbia, King's having been a rather awkward name in the Revolutionary era, but
Exactly.
even as undergraduate extraordinaire, Hamilton is writing blazing polemical pamphlets against the British. He's drilling with students in a nearby churchyard. He's delivering spellbinding
He's
speeches
one of
to
the
large
Sons of
crowds.
Liberty, isn't
He's
he?
one of the Sons of Liberty, yeah. So, you know, this is one of the rare cases in history of an intellectual who also is a daredevil and who's willing to court physical danger throughout the Revolution, if not the rest of his
There's
life.
a wonderful scene in the book where the then president of King's College, I forget the name,
Miles Cooper.
Miles Cooper, who's a loyalist and is being threatened by a crowd, essentially the Sons of Liberty, in rather roustaboutish and uncouth manner, so that he may well be in danger of his life, or
That's
at
right. This is
least.
a very significant episode, maybe the most significant episode in his early life, because this drunken, rampaging mob of patriots swoops down on the college. They're hoping to seize Miles Cooper, the Tory president, and tar and feather him. Young Hamilton stands in the doorway. He courageously blocks their path. And what I argue in the book is that this shows that he has a certain ambivalence about revolution. He wants liberty, but he also, more than the other founders, dreads disorder. And so
At
that
this
you
time,
have
he's
this.
already one of the leaders of the Sons of Liberty.
Oh, yeah, he had been making these rabble-rousing speeches
But he stops the
himself.
crowd and says, "You can't do
He
this."
stops the crowd. There is some instinct, you know, for rule of law and respect for people and property that is always warring with these revolutionary
And
impulses.
that great contrast between the value of order and the value of liberty is one of his essentially obsessive concerns through all of his career.
Yeah, and I think that it becomes very significant. For instance, Hamilton becomes a great and prophetic critic of the French Revolution because he feels with the French Revolution that the very one-sided concentration on liberty and the disregard of order creates revolutionary excesses. He makes a famous statement, "Revolutions are apt to hurry even good men into excesses." I think one of the most important things that that Hamilton did is to break a certain kind of revolutionary fervor. Revolutions tend to, you know, devour their children. Revolutions tend to feed upon themselves. And I think more than anyone else, it's Hamilton at the end of the American Revolution who recognizes that the mores of peacetime, that the requirements of peace are very different from the requirements of war and revolution.
Revolutions not only tend to devour their children, they tend to turn into tyrannies.
And Hamilton realized that, you know, and Hamilton realized that anarchy was as great a threat to liberty as despotism. And this leads him in very, very different directions from his Jeffersonian opponents. The idea being that you can have excess liberty. And what bothered Hamilton about it was not having too much liberty. It's that it would lead through this historic dialectic to despotism.
And that is a good part of the content of and the concern of the Federalist Papers, and much else that he wrote, and of much that he did in terms of taking important policy positions when he was in government. He was, of course, Secretary of the Treasury under George Washington. But we'll come to him in his post-revolutionary years shortly. But let's go back to the revolution and just tell the story.
Yeah, no, he becomes the aide-de-camp to George Washington
at
age 22.
So quickly?
Well, you know, this is one of these people, Milt. Everyone who met Alexander Hamilton in his life instantly sensed that this was a young man of exceptional intelligence combined with extraordinary charm and stamina. He apparently was one of these people, if you spoke to him even for 5 minutes, you would realize that he was a young genius. He was the captain of an artillery company, even as he was still an undergraduate at King's. And various Revolutionary War generals, Nathaniel Greene, Henry Knox, and notably George Washington, watch him drilling his men, watch him in battle, and are amazed by his skill, his organization, his seriousness, his intelligence, and also just his physical courage.
You say watch him in battle. When is he first blooded, so to speak?
Well, he's actually... when, you know, the British started out with their own shock and awe campaign against us, they brought into New York Harbor in the early days of the Revolution a flotilla. It was the largest expeditionary force until D-Day. It was over 30,000 men, over 300 ships. And Hamilton, who was the captain of this artillery company, was down at the Battery, the tip of Lower Manhattan, when the 32,000 British and Hessian soldiers suddenly sail into New York Harbor, and the ships start moving up the harbor and strafing the town. So from the very beginning, Hamilton is not simply one of the great intellectual theoreticians of the revolution, but he literally is on the front line. Yeah, and so there are battlefield heroics here.
And he's directing cannon fire against some of those ships.
Against some of those ships. In fact, the strange thing is, during the 4 years that he's effectively Washington's chief of staff, you'd think that he would be thrilled. This orphaned, illegitimate kid from the Caribbean comes out of nowhere. He suddenly is Washington's right hand.
At the top rank of colonel, wasn't it?
Yeah, he was colonel. Yeah. But he dreams of battlefield glory. In fact, there's tension between Hamilton and Washington, because Hamilton knows, Hamilton's very ambitious. I think that he knew that in the post-war political world, that the political laurels would not go to the person who wrote the best correspondence for George Washington, but as always in war, the person who engaged in the the battlefield heroics. And so there's a marvelous scene at Yorktown. Hamilton leads the battalion that storms the outer ramparts. He rises out of the trench. He sprints across the field. You know, there are shells exploding over him, and he leaps up on the parapet, and he yells for his men to follow him. And so this is a very kind of colorful, dashing character, as well as a great intellect.
You do a tremendously effective representation, not merely of his life and his involvement in this early part of his career in the Revolutionary War, and in the rather cold encampments of the army. We've got Valley Forge here represented in a way that absolutely chills me just to read about it.
Yeah.
But also, we learn a good deal about, I get a good deal of the feel of the way the revolution was waged, not merely with a focus on Hamilton, but with the focus on the movement of armies and the dilemmas that George Washington faced.
Yeah, actually, the Revolutionary War, there were not a lot of large, direct engagements. Even when he was an undergraduate, Hamilton wrote this paper where he essentially outlined the strategy for a mobile defensive war of attrition. He knew that the British would have this overwhelming strength.
And he says, we don't meet them in the field. That's not the way for us to fight this war. Essentially, he says, we wage something like what these days we would call a guerrilla war.
Yeah, and Hamilton actually sees this, that you take advantage of the fact you're scrappy, you're opportunistic, you keep on the move, and you eventually wear the enemy down, because it was basically a political battle, and so the American side knew that the British public would eventually lose its taste for war if it went on too long.
Sounds like America in Vietnam a little bit, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, this is not the first time this kind of war has been waged, yeah.
One would have thought, or the one has developed the impression on the basis of other things that one has read, the one in each instance being me, but I think I speak for many, that Washington was viewed as heroic and as monumental and as above all the others from the very beginning. That turns out not to be the case at all.
No, it was very interesting to study the life of George Washington, from whom I have immense admiration, but to see Washington through the filter of Hamilton's life, because Hamilton is his chief of staff for 4 years, and Hamilton finds Washington moody, irritable, snappish, a highly emotional and difficult boss. In fact, Hamilton finally provokes a confrontation so that he could leave Washington's staff, and he tells his father-in-law, he said, I'm tired of putting up with Washington's moods. This is very different from the kind of granite figure with the craggy face that we see in the Gilbert Stuart.
And baby. Also, I learned from this book, and I just suppose I hadn't read enough of the history of the Revolutionary War and of the inner politics of the war, that there were those within the army who were constantly gunning for Washington, particularly a major figure who had won
Horatio Gates. Yeah, who was the hero of the Battle of Saratoga. And there was the so-called Conway Cabal. There was a whole active group both in the Continental Congress and also in the Army who wanted to depose Washington. The thing about George Washington is that he was not a great military genius, may be underrated. Only won, I think, three major engagements during the Revolution. That was not his great contribution, simply holding the Continental Army together, simply holding the patriotic cause intact was his greatest achievement, and that was as much a political as a military achievement. Although I know a book recently came out, Washington's Crossing, that's kind of arguing that Washington, in fact, has been underrated as a military leader.
Did Hamilton play a crucial role in saving Washington's position, particularly when the Gates challenge had been mounted?
Yeah, I don't think that Hamilton, you know, was powerful enough to have played.
But he sent by Washington up to see Gates to get some portion of Gates's army.
Yeah, well, actually, what happens after the Battle of Saratoga, the great turning point of the war, this instantly converts, you know, Horatio Gates into the hero of of the hour. As far as Washington was concerned, because Burgoyne and his army had been captured, this removed the major threat from the north, which meant that a lot of Horatio Gates's men and several brigades should be transferred south to Washington. Horatio Gates was very reluctant to give up his men. Washington sends Hamilton 300 miles to personally negotiate with Gates. And this is really quite an amazing moment because Hamilton would have been, 23 at the time. He has full powers. He has plenary powers to order Horatio Gates around. In fact, Gates doesn't want to relinquish the men.
And Gates is lieutenant general or something like that?
Well, Horatio, Gates was the general of the Northern Department of the Continental
Army. Almost holding equal status as Washington did.
Yeah, and in fact, at the moment, since he was the hero of the hour, really the most powerful general. But because it took Hamilton several days of riding to reach Gates, Washington had to invest Hamilton with full power for this 23-year-old to boss around the most powerful general other than Washington in the army, which Hamilton proceeds to do. Gates, as a result, thought that Hamilton was this insolent young upstart, and forever after hated Hamilton. Hamilton had a capacity. You either loved him or hated him. He was a very strong personality, and nobody was ever neutral.
Well, brilliant young guys zooming forward and beating everybody with their skills, with their accomplishments, with their ability to master whole new arts and whole new systems in just the blink of an eye, whereas all the rest of us kind of plod along. People of that sort do elicit great life-lasting admiration and, on the part of others, great life-lasting enmity.
Now, this is, one reason I think Hamilton develops a lot of political enemies, and it's almost a left-handed tribute to him, because he's so brilliant. It's a mark of their fear for him. This is somebody who can speak in perfectly worded paragraphs for hours on an end. As a lawyer, he would get up and talk for hours.
Writes beautifully.
He writes beautifully. He was able and did often in Washington's administration. He could toss off a 5, 10, 20,000-word memo overnight. So if you disagreed with him politically, your fear of him was magnified by your estimation of his talents, which
he's
good looking.
He carries himself very well, apparently. He's bilingual, absolutely fluent in French as well as English.
That's right. His mother was French Huguenot, and so his French was far, far superior to the French spoken by Franklin, Jefferson, and Adams, all of whom spent months or even years in Paris.
All of whom were ambassadors. Yeah.
All of whom were ambassadors to France. Hamilton, who never set foot in Europe, spoke this absolutely flawless French. But you're right, he was handsome, he was elegant, he was charming. You could picture him in a European court, and he's dangerously sure of himself. And as always, when you meet someone who's extraordinarily talented and very sure of himself, it heightens the anxiety of everyone else in the room.
And these guys waging the revolution are making a new country. And they know that by virtue of their role in the great revolutionary struggle, they are in a position to go forward into important political prominence and maybe other kinds of prominence as well in the emerging nation.
Yeah, absolutely. Very often people will ask me the question, how is it that we suddenly had these five or six universal geniuses just when we needed them? I think it was a moment where there was suddenly a vacuum. You're abolishing the old order, you suddenly have to create a new order. And I think that, intellectuals like Hamilton, Madison, who under ordinary circumstances might have been, warming a chair in an Ivy League university, are suddenly drawn right into the center of the political arena because there was an immediate, really quite urgent need for fresh ideas, also for people to thought in terms of new political blueprints and systems. It was just a moment that where these people, instead of being more marginal in society, were right at the center.
The war ends at Yorktown. He's there.
Yeah.
The French have helped us win at Yorktown.
Absolutely. Which indispensable.
By blocking the harbor. Essentially,
yeah, preventing the French from escaping.
Yeah,
and Hamilton, interestingly enough, already by that point, he's writing a series of famous essays on the need to merge the 13 states into a more powerful union. Actually, by Yorktown, he has already written a 13-page letter to a politician in New York calling for a constitutional convention. He also, throughout the revolution, he's giving himself a crash course in history and finance and politics. He's lugging around these huge volumes called Dictionary of Trade and Commerce. And we have his paybook. He took 112 pages of notes from these different political economists. It was like he was already in training to be the first Treasury Secretary.
A term that should be used for him is autodidact.
Completely.
He taught himself. That is, he let the books that he read teach him. But he read just about everything.
Yeah, this, as a writer, this was a little bit frustrating to study Hamilton's life. He had read everything. He retains everything. Everything becomes useful to him. Everything is kind of perfectly slotted and pigeonholed in the right place in his mind. So this is really a life, 49 years. There doesn't seem to have been a wasted moment intellectually.
When the war is over, he goes back to school to get a law degree, in effect.
Yeah, and again, heroic exploits. At the time in New York, it usually took 3 years of working as an apprentice to an established lawyer to practice law. Hamilton does it in 6 months of self-study. Everything about his life, it's sort of boy wonder at every step of the way.
Probably reads and memorizes virtually all of Blackwell. among
Well,
other
also what he does, he has this crib sheet. He starts copying out different legal procedures and practices. Being Hamilton, he does it so brilliantly that it becomes a textbook for a generation of New York lawyers. And it goes on like that. There's never a dull moment in the life of Alexander Hamilton.
How does he emerge into national, secular, non-military life? Essentially as a writer.
As a writer, I think that because he was this orphaned kid, he was living by his wits. He had this extraordinary power with words. He's writing and publishing absolutely throughout his entire life. He never published anything under his own name. He's always writing under Roman pseudonyms.
Often Publius.
Publius was Federalist papers.
Yeah.
He wrote 51 of the 85 Federalist papers.
By the way, why was that done that way? I know it wasn't unique to his style, but quite commonly men would publish
it was common at the time, and tremendously intensified, I think, the hostility of politics at the time, since you didn't need to sign the article. Sometimes people knew who was hiding behind
you could be nastier than you would be otherwise.
You could be nastier. Exactly.
And he was often quite nasty.
Well, just before we drop the idea of the Roman pseudonyms, I have to tell you one story. At one point, he launches a series. This was while he was Treasury Secretary. He launches a series of essays under the name of Camillus. Then he launches a parallel series under the name of Philo Camillus, friend of Camillus, where he's praising the brilliance of Camillus. So I counted there were moments where simultaneously he was using as many as five or six different pseudonyms. But you're right, Milton, he could be very nasty. His style of polemics was absolutely brutal, both on a personal and political level. And then, strangely enough, when people were burned by his pen, if that's the right metaphor, he seemed to be very surprised that they were as angry at him as they were. He was a lot better at dishing it out than taking it.
We need to pause in just a moment for a quick update on the evening's news. And after that, we need to look at the years in the doldrums for the country. That is the period when we worked under the Articles of the
Confederation.
Mm-hmm. And then his role in the making of the Constitution and the transformation of the nation into the United States of America. We return directly to Ron Chernow. We're drawing from his masterly new volume, Alexander Hamilton, which is, by the way, just published by Penguin, I believe.
Penguin Press, yes.
And we will return directly after a quick update, and we return to Ron Chernow. Let's begin to make the country. What is he doing during those years when the country is sort of is not yet a country, is floundering as separate states trying to decide how to relate to one another?
Well, he has a very busy legal practice. He also is a congressman. There's no downtime in the life of Alexander Hamilton, but he's very, very worried about the state of the country under the Articles of Confederation, which was quite chaotic. I mean, for instance, we had internal tariffs so that the people in New Jersey were very upset that goods imported through the Port of New York, those revenues would go to New York, and then the people from New Jersey would essentially pay the tax. There was a big movement to repudiate debt that finally culminated in Shays' Rebellion. Some people will remember that from school. These angry farmers in Pennsylvania who felt oppressed by taxes and foreclosures and who started seizing government arsenals.
Is it Shays' Rebellion that remobilizes George Washington, or is it the Whiskey Rebellion?
It's the Whiskey Rebellion later on.
He comes in there on his horse and puts down that rebellion.
Yeah, well, actually, in the Whiskey Rebellion, because Hamilton and Washington rode out from Philadelphia, went to western Pennsylvania to put down the Whiskey Rebellion. They were at the head of an army that was actually larger than any army they commanded during
Isn't
the American Revolution. Yeah, Americans liked their whiskey.
Let's jump forward to the making of the Constitution and the transformation, the fusion of the states into a federal government. He, of course, is the great proponent of federalism, and his famous papers, written together with John Jay and with Madison,
The Federalist Papers,
are called the Federalist Papers.
The Federalist Papers, The Federalist Papers were written in order to influence delegate selection to the New York State Ratifying Convention. Let me explain this. You know, after the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia, the delegates felt that it was very important that the Constitution derive its legitimacy not from the state legislatures, but directly from the people, we the people. So they decided that they would hold a convention in each state, and when nine state conventions had ratified that the Constitution would be activated. In order to influence the delegate selection for New York, Hamilton launches the Federalist Papers. Hamilton, again, Wonder Boy, writes 51 of the 85. As if that were not extraordinary enough, at moments he's publishing as many as 5 or 6 per week. As if that were not extraordinary enough, he's doing it as a sideline. He had a full-time legal practice, and we have evidence of him scratching away at such a rate that the printer would be in the outer office ready to pull the paper out of his hand.
Now, let's look at the content, basically. It would be quite a challenge, almost an impossible task, to summarize the basic argument of the Federalist Papers. All the same, I invite you to do so.
Okay, let me just kind of, you know, give a sense of the anatomy of it, because it starts out, Hamilton does the first one, then John Jay does a series of 4 about foreign policy. Madison then explains the weakness of Confederacies. Madison explains the general anatomy of the government, because Madison was really the major architect at the Constitutional Convention of the overall design of the government. Madison and a lot of delegates at the time felt that the most important institution of the new government would be the House of Representatives, that this would actually be, as it were, the engine of the government. So Madison handles the section on the House of the Representatives. He then splits the Senate with Hamilton. Then what happens is Madison has to go back to Virginia to secure passage for the Constitution in Virginia. So suddenly Hamilton, and then John Jay has a bout of rheumatism. Hamilton is left alone with the Federalist Papers. He writes the remaining section on the Senate. He writes the entire section on the presidency. He writes the entire section on the judiciary, the military, taxation, etc. He was writing at such speed. He had to have all of this kind of perfectly organized in his mind.
Now, what's the underlying proposition or set of propositions that runs through the whole volume, so to speak?
Well, first, I think the weakness of confederations historically, and that the weakness of the confederation would eventually result in chaos, in disorder. Hamilton was a strong believer that these 13 states had the potential, if welded together into a strong union, of being a very, very powerful nation state. He felt that confederacies were doomed to degenerate into civil war and chaos. And you have to understand at the time that the founders, who were all very kind of nervous, pessimistic men, were very afraid of foreign intrigues. They thought that if the weakness of the Confederacy continued, there might not only be disunion, there might be civil war. They were afraid that France, England, Spain would begin to tamper again. So it was partly just, you know, defensive and protective. A lot of the, we were talking before about Hamilton being this ambivalent revolutionary wanting liberty and disorder. A lot of it is striking a kind of perfect balance between, on the one hand, expressing the will of the people, translating that into political programs, but also, as it were, throwing sand into the machinery to prevent popular passions from carrying the government into dangerous excesses.
What was the opposing force, if they perceived any?
The opposing force of...
In terms of the nature of the argument, the nature of the potential design of the government.
Oh, well, you know, again, during this period, many people tended to see everything through the lens of the British experience. This was one of the major things Hamilton had to overcome. Hamilton had to point out that you could have a strong executive branch, you could have a strong president, without it necessarily replicating, you know, the British model. Also things that, for instance, you needed taxation, you needed central banks, you needed different governmental institutions that in a lot of people's minds were damned because they were associated with England. And ergo, anything that was associated with England by definition...
Who were the prominent people who took that position?
Well, you know, most significantly for Hamilton was from New York State, and the governor of New York State, George Clinton, was a fanatical opponent of the Constitution, which was a constant problem for Hamilton. But even someone like Jefferson, Jefferson was really quite ambivalent about the Constitution, because Jefferson comes to embody, you know, the one great pole of American public opinion in terms of having a very weak central government, very strong states' rights, strict construction of the Constitution. Hamilton comes to embody the other pole, which is a strong union, strong executive branch, vigorous presidency, and a very flexible interpretation of the Constitution. And it's Hamilton, really, who is closely studying the experiences of the French, the British, and the Dutch, a time when Jefferson and some of the other founders, I think, were so caught up in the idea that the United States would be a beacon to the rest of the world, that they didn't see that the United States also had a lot to
learn. We're talking about federalism versus, what should we call the other view?
They were called anti-federalists, the people who opposed the Constitution.
There are even anti-federalist papers, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, and in fact, you know, a lot of people said Hamilton's party was called the Federalists. Today, when we talk of federalism, we're talking about a position almost the opposite of the federalism that Hamilton represented, which was a strong union. Some people claim that there was a deliberate obfuscation going on, that the Federalists, in order to oppose this idea that the federal government was going to nullify the states, deliberately seized a name that was the opposite of what it meant.
You mentioned Jefferson. Of course, there's also an opposition in terms of the kind of country that they look forward to, sort of the ideal model of whether the United States should be essentially a pastoral nation or whether it should be an industrial one. The Industrial Revolution is beginning to gear up. Commerce is beginning already to be sort of, if not global, it's beginning to be international. And the question is, where will the United States go? Jefferson and Hamilton have very different
diametrically opposed ideas on this, because Jefferson foresees a kind of agrarian Eden. We would all be yeoman farmers. And I think it's important to understand, in terms of the way that Hamilton has been perceived historically, that Hamilton is really the visionary. He foresees a country of banks, stock exchanges, you know, corporations, factories, plus traditional agriculture. A lot of these activities, like banks and stock exchanges, back in the 18th century, by Jefferson, Madison, even John Adams, saw these as inherently evil activities. So anyone like Hamilton, who was advocating these things, which we take for granted nowadays, would automatically have been considered an evil person.
I think that evil, that sense that those things are evil, go back to the prohibition against usury, which is associated with early Christianity.
Yeah, and also a lot of these are kind of traditional attitudes in agricultural areas. They're also kind of, you know, traditional landed gentry attitudes, that commerce is grubby, finance is a swindle. All of these attitudes come to play. In fact, I have this whole section in the book where I just describe what the founding fathers thought about the basic institutions of capitalism, because we think of the essence of America being the combination of democracy and capitalism. Certainly all the founders are very, very strong on democracy. But when it comes to capitalism, except for maybe Ben Franklin, Hamilton is kind of in a class by himself. He's very interested in the Industrial Revolution. He's closely studying the British textile industry. He actually is involved in a project to start a kind of futuristic industrial village in Paterson, New Jersey, and creates textile factories. He's actually stealing some of the foremen from the British textile plants in order to start a textile industry in the United States. So I say in the book, he's the messenger from the future. He's the one who actually foresaw the country that we inhabit today.
And then he is put into a position, or he achieves for himself the position which enables him to have tremendous influence on the shaping of these institutions. Once the first election occurs and Washington is inaugurated, the cabinet is appointed, and the Secretary of the Treasury, designated by George Washington,
was Alexander Hamilton.
Alexander Hamilton.
He was 34. And just to give a sense of how powerful he was, today the cabinet has 15 department heads. At that time, there were only three: Thomas Jefferson, Secretary of State; Henry Knox, Secretary of War; and Hamilton at Treasury. Treasury Department was much larger than the rest of the government combined by far. Hamilton had to create from scratch a customs service. He created Coast Guard. First tax system, first budget system, first central bank, in other words, forerunner of the Federal Reserve, takes a country completely bankrupted by Revolutionary War debt, restores public credit, and equally important, he's making the enduring constitutional arguments to Washington that these activities are, in fact, permitted under the Constitution at a time when Jefferson and Madison are taking a much more narrow view. For instance, they argued that a central bank, you know, a Federal Reserve today, they argue that a central bank was, in fact, unconstitutional. Hamilton developed some very powerful legal doctrines, like implied powers, saying it's not just what specifically is mentioned in the Constitution, but anything that really is a kind of necessary means to those ends. Well, this tremendously expanded the powers of the federal government in terms of responding to emergencies, in terms of creating the basic economic institutions of the country.
And also it has a consequence, his innovations have the consequence of enriching the country once again.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
getting rid of the debt and, in fact, getting things moving so that the gross national product is highly advantageous.
Yeah, well, you know, everyone was aware in the first government that the whole democratic system was being tested. And so Hamilton felt very strongly that not only did liberties have to be guaranteed, but the government had to produce prosperity. The government had to guarantee order because people were not yet, you know, wedded to this government, or even, you know, wedded to the whole democratic experiment. So he in Washington felt that it was absolutely imperative that the first administration be a success.
Is he partly the inventor of modern state-guided or state-assisted capitalism, or is he drawing upon models that were available in Europe?
Well, you know, Hamilton wrote a famous report on manufacturers. This preceded his creation of this futuristic industrial city in Paterson, New Jersey. Hamilton developed this theory of, you know, infant industries needed protection, needed special protections, needed bounties, needed some form of government protection and assistance. Very often people say to me, well, wasn't he kind of an early advocate of industrial planning? I don't think so, because he felt that we were a developed country. We were competing in a world of very established nations. I'm not sure that, you know, you can extrapolate from that and say that if you were alive today, he would feel that these industries needed any special protection. So this was part of his theory of the development of a new nation state.
Why didn't he stay in government longer than those few years as Secretary of the Treasury?
He was broke. I mean, he did stay more than 5 years. It was a tremendous financial sacrifice. The finances of the country were in much better shape than Hamilton's.
He chose to leave. He chose to leave so as to...
He chose to leave. I think that he felt that he'd accomplished what he wanted. Yeah. This was somebody who, you know, had a wife and ultimately 8 children. Yeah. So he had a large and growing family to take care of. And the funny thing is, Milt, that there were all sorts of fantasies and myths at the time from his Jeffersonian opponents that there was a secret bank account in London and that the Crown was stashing away money for Hamilton, or that he was secretly speculating in Treasury securities and was really rich. Instead, he was going broke in government service.
Well, that suggests to me that the next thing we ought to begin to look at is the enemies of Alexander Hamilton and what made them so intolerant of and so angry at this brilliant fellow.
Yeah.
We pause to do what we can to keep commerce going well in this country, and then we return to Ron Chernow, author of Alexander Hamilton, this major, significant, and utterly readable, totally compelling new biography just published by Penguin. We return right after this. And returning to Ron Chernow and to his great new biography of Alexander Hamilton. The simple question I posed a moment ago, I repeat, who were the enemies and why were they so negative towards Alexander Hamilton?
Well, to name Alexander Hamilton's enemies, John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, James Monroe, and I'll even throw in John Quincy Adams and Andrew Jackson for good measure. You notice, Milt, that I just named presidents 2 through 7.
Yeah.
Luckily, Hamilton had a great champion in president number 1, or he could not have withstood all of those attacks. He really had a very, very impressive list of enemies. What you often say to people, too, is he also had a very, very impressive list of
But
of
why
friends.
Were presidents 2 to 7 anti-Hamilton?
Well, they thought that his vision of the country was leading it in exactly the wrong direction of too powerful a central government. They were opposed to the fact that Hamilton wanted to introduce what we would now think of as all of these modern economic and financial institutions. They were probably the most bitter split in the country during the period was between the Jeffersonians, who wanted closer relations with France, versus the Hamiltonians, who wanted closer relations with Britain. Hamilton was horrified given the bloodshed and the radicalism of the French Revolution, and also what he saw as the atheism of the French Revolution. He was horrified that Jefferson and his followers wanted closer ties with France. Jefferson and his allies were horrified that Hamilton would want closer relations with the country that we had just, you know, fought an eight-year war with to escape from dependence upon England.
Was there
England.
Any correspondence between Hamilton and Edmund Burke?
That's a very good question, because there are distinct parallels in their political philosophy. In fact, there are a lot of different places in Hamilton's writings where he's talking about the importance of custom and tradition.
And also distinct parallels in their attitudes towards the French Revolution.
Absolutely. And so Hamilton had the same horror towards the French Revolution. And yet, you know, in the immense 27-volume set of collected papers, I think that I only counted two passing references to Edmund Burke, even though Hamilton seems like very much the kind of American,
the American
counterpart.
Burke,
yeah.
The enmity, though, wasn't only on the basis of disagreements on matters of policy and program. There were some personal themes as well.
Yeah, you know, Hamilton's style was very, very slashing. And when he would write essays against his opponents, he would take them apart personally as well as politically. For instance, with Jefferson, and this at the time must have been much more puzzling than it would be now. Every time Hamilton wrote an essay about Jefferson, there would always be some line, not only, well, he said Jefferson was a fanatic in politics and atheist in religion, but he would always have a line about Jefferson being a secret voluptuary. He always said that Jefferson was a secret sensualist. At the time, maybe these references were puzzling, but in light of everything we now know about Jefferson and Sally Hemings, I think that it's pretty clear that Hamilton knew about that. I actually discovered an essay where Hamilton is taunting Jefferson on the racial issue, and he's saying, surely Mr. Jefferson knows all about the staining that takes place in the relationship between masters and slaves. And sort of reading between the lines, he seems to be suggesting that he knows about Jefferson and Sally Hemings. And of course, that was a commonplace of slavery, of the master having his way with the female slaves. It was just that Jefferson was understandably horrified to have anyone suggest this in print.
It's merely a side note or a footnote, but is it now the scholarly consensus that the Jefferson-Hemings affair is fully established? I thought there was some questioning, particularly with regard to whether they had a common child.
Yeah, I would say kind of most scholars would say 99% certain. The genetic tests have shown, you know, that the Hemings descendants are descended from a Jefferson
male.
Now, kind of what takes that from the realm of possibility to the realm of likelihood is that we have evidence that exactly 9 months prior to every one of Sally Hemings' pregnancies, that Jefferson, who was very often away from Monticello, was at Monticello exactly 9 months before. And, you know, what people don't realize about this is that the Sally Hemings affair was not revealed 2 centuries later by scholars digging back in the records. It was revealed while Jefferson was president, and in fact it was revealed by the same scandal-mongering journalist who revealed a sexual affair that Hamilton had James T. Callender revealed both of the great sexual scandals of the early republic. Jefferson had Sally Hemings, Hamilton had Mrs. Reynolds.
We must come to that.
Okay.
What's just tell that story.
The story's incredible. Hamilton, at the height of his power as a secretary, 1791, beautiful 23-year-old woman named Maria Reynolds comes to his door, knocks on it in Philadelphia, spills out this woeful tale that she's been abandoned by her husband, James Reynolds, and pleads for financial aid. Hamilton said he went around to her rooming house that night, found her at the top of the stairs. She invites him into the bedroom, and in one of his greatest lines, he said, "When we went into the bedroom, Mrs. Reynolds made it clear that other than pecuniary consolation would be acceptable." He then has an affair with Mrs. Reynolds for a year, and who suddenly reappears but Mr. Reynolds? Mr. Reynolds doesn't stop the affair. He decides that he simply is going to tax the affair, and Hamilton begins to pay blackmail money to James Reynolds. This goes on for a year, and a lot of people have commented. Hamilton was a man with seemed to enjoy tempting fate and courting danger. He had a kind of gambler's instinct. There were actually a lot of commentary with Bill and Monica that Hamilton was a similar kind of personality. Very bright, very charming, kind of convinced that he could get away with things and enjoy tempting fate.
High risk sort of makes the game.
Yeah, there was kind of
narcissistic
quality about the personality, and it wasn't the story wasn't revealed until 5 years later. And what happened was his political enemies said that the money that he was paying to James Reynolds was not for adultery, but it was because Hamilton was secretly speculating in Treasury securities with James Reynolds. So Hamilton publishes a 95-page pamphlet, you heard correctly, 95-page pamphlet, in order to actually admit to the adultery as a way of saying that he wasn't involved in improper speculation with James Reynolds. No, no, no. The money was actually being paid for the favor of having sex with Mrs. Reynolds. A lot of his friends thought that a couple of discreet paragraphs would have done the trick. But he didn't need to.
But he gives considerable detail.
95 pages.
Bedroom detail, so to speak.
Yeah, you know, Hamilton was a writer, and he kind of turns this whole tale almost into like something out of Tom Jones.
Now, you were very impressed by his wife. We've
yes.
not mentioned her at all yet.
Yeah.
How does she handle herself during this dreadful period?
Well, she's long-suffering. You know, we don't have any letter from her at the time indicating her attitude. But I think before I wrote this book, it was assumed that because Hamilton had gotten caught up in this notorious affair, it must have been an unhappy marriage. I'm absolutely convinced and hope I show that this was an unusually happy marriage of a woman who made large and necessary allowances for her husband. Eliza Hamilton actually lived for 50 years after the duel. She died in November 1854, and she spent a lot of those 50 years preserving his memory, lovingly preserving every scrap that he ever wrote, while systematically destroying her own papers to keep the spotlight on her.
Was he a womanizer, or was Maria Reynolds one of a kind?
Good question. Clearly, Hamilton had an eye for the ladies. He was fatally attracted to the ladies. The ladies were fatally attracted to Hamilton. He was very handsome and charming. But I also point out in the book that for all of the discussion on this topic, there are only two women whose names have ever been connected with him, in spite of legions of enemies who would have pounced on any indiscretion. The other woman, it's also a very fascinating story, was Angelica Church, who happened to be his sister-in-law. And there's no question that he was smitten with his sister-in-law, Angelica, who was the older sister of his wife. She was a very kind of beautiful and fashionable, sophisticated Hamilton's wife, Eliza. You know, was kind of the sturdy, sensible, plainer, younger sister. I think that these two women formed a kind of composite perfect woman for Hamilton. But I don't know that the relationship with Angelica was ever consummated. I'm a little bit dubious since his in-laws always adored Hamilton. And had there really been a big-time whiff of scandal about Hamilton and his sister-in-law, I can't imagine that his in-laws would have adored him that much.
One of the saddest things, and one of the most noteworthy, inevitably, because it's so dramatic, is the way he was cut off long before he should have been cut off. The death. In a duel, the other duelist being Aaron Burr, once Vice President of the United States.
Yeah.
We've got some commercials coming, and we'll pause in just a moment, and then we have to look at the end. But even before we do that, it's time to invite telephone calls. We're opening lines. Anything you'd like to ask, or for that matter, anything you'd like to offer by way of interpretation or commentary is more than welcome. The number, as ever, is 591-7200. 591-7200 if you want to communicate via email. The email address, extension 720, as one word, extension 720, at tribune.com. The lines are open, 591-7200. We will return directly after these words. And we will be shortly on to the phones. 591-7200, if you want to join us. You can get your call in now. We'll be with you shortly. But let's come back to the saddest part of the story, namely the early death of Alexander Hamilton. Why in the world did did the Vice President of the United States, as he then was, Aaron Burr, and the former Secretary of the Treasury go out to Weehawken and across the river in New Jersey to try to kill each other.
Well, you know, Hamilton and Burr were the two national politicians from New York, and in part this was a battle over, you know, political turf in New York. Hamilton's career was in decline because of the exposure of the Reynolds affair and other political blunders that he had committed. Burr's career was in decline because Thomas Jefferson had just decided to drop Burr from the ticket as vice president in 1804. Burr then went back to New York, tried to become governor of New York, and Hamilton blocked him from becoming governor. Hamilton had blocked Burr from becoming president during the famous tie election of 1800. So Aaron Burr decides that New York is not big enough for Aaron Burr and Alexander Hamilton. He reads in a newspaper that Hamilton has uttered a despicable opinion about him at an Albany dinner party, and he writes to Hamilton asking for a retraction or an apology for the despicable opinion. Hamilton replies in this very kind of angry, legalistic matter. He says, "Sir, despicable admits of many shades of opinion," and the correspondence goes from there. It becomes angrier and angrier, and it ends up on the dueling ground. These were two very kind of, you know, proud men, whom I think each one, certainly Burr, thought that he could redeem his political reputation.
It was Burr that first gave the challenge for the
duel. Yeah, and in fact, that's a significant point, because Hamilton, on six previous occasions, had nearly ended up on the dueling ground, and it was, as it were, settled out of court.
A fascinating background to this is that one of Hamilton's sons died in a duel.
Yeah, Hamilton's eldest son, Philip, a very handsome, bright boy who just graduated from Columbia, had died in a duel 2.5 years earlier. This puts Hamilton in a strange position because, in fact, he had lived by the dueling code. All the previous times, though, he had issued the challenge and he had gotten the person to issue an apology or a retraction. Now he finds, because he's been involved, you know, in these so-called affairs of honor six times before, he can't turn down the invitation to duel without looking cowardly and hypocritical. On the other hand, his own 19-year-old son has been killed in a duel 2.5 years before, so he's developed a principal opposition to dueling. So he decides to go out to the dueling ground at Weehawken, New Jersey, with this rather complicated strategy. He's going to go to the dueling ground, one, and show that he has the courage to face a bullet from Aaron Burr. Two, because he's opposed to dueling, he's going to waste his shot. He's going to fire in the air. And Hamilton did fire into the air. Burr fired directly into Hamilton. Hamilton was killed on the first shot.
Did they fire at the same moment, or did Burr, in cold intention, fire after he knew that the other guy wasn't giving any challenge?
We'll never be able to say for certain. I actually think what happened is that Hamilton fired first, and that he fired first because he wanted to show Burr that he was wasting his shot, because the bullet went about 12 feet high and 4 feet wide of Aaron Burr. What would happen then is that Burr had all the time in the world to fire back. The objective of a duel was not to kill the other person, because if you blew his brains out, people would denounce you as a murderer, however illogically. The aim was you would try to clip someone in the arm or the leg. The seconds would come out and you would negotiate a solution. So the fact that Burr, who had taken target practice, who is an expert marksman, killed Hamilton suggests that he may indeed have tried. But we could never say for certain. These are kind of, you know, big, heavy, unwieldy pistols with big bullets.
What do we know about the character of Aaron Burr and about the interesting, odd life of Aaron Burr?
Well, you know, Hamilton and Burr, about the same age, had these very intertwined lives. They were friends. They'd socialized together. They argued a lot of legal cases together as well as against each other. Their personalities were completely different. You know, as I've tried to describe, Hamilton was this extravagantly verbal person, just promiscuous with his opinions, couldn't keep a secret to save his life. Aaron Burr was this very bright and charming man, but he was enigmatic and sphinx-like. Where Hamilton's papers run to 22,000 pages, Burr, they're kind of like these two slim volumes of papers, because Burr told people, things written remain. So he didn't like to commit his positions to paper. Also, whenever he had a political discussion, it was always one-on-one without a witness in the room. So where Hamilton is always the strutting genius center stage, Aaron Burr is a very kind of, you know, cool and cagey character.
We must go to the phones. People are clamoring to get into this conversation, and we will now turn to them. 591-7200 is the number, and you are on the air. Good evening.
Hi, good evening. It's a great work. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you.
It's always good to hear buzz about the founders. And it's great to see that history has not killed the biography yet. I'm wondering if you could comment on Hamilton's relationship with Madison after the convention, as Madison began to align himself with Jefferson.
Yes, this is a wonderful question, because Alexander Hamilton's life, you know, breaks down into a series of titanic feuds or friendships with the other founders who either love him or loathe him. The only figure in the story who's first Hamilton's friend and then becomes Hamilton's enemy is James Madison, because at the Constitutional Convention, and when they're co-authoring the Federalist Papers, they're great comrades in arms. And Hamilton, as Treasury Secretary, is absolutely shocked when Madison, in fact, leads the attack on his programs as Treasury Secretary. He felt it as a personal betrayal, and I think that when Jefferson and Madison became his great enemies, there was much more sadness about Madison. I think that Hamilton thought that Madison was an incorruptible man. I think that he thought that Madison was a much deeper and more original thinker than Jefferson. He saw as more kind of dogmatic and fanatical, but I think that in Madison he was saddened to think that he had lost a true political ally, if not friend.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Glad to have heard from you, and we will go quickly to another on 591-7200. Good evening.
Good evening. Very interesting, Milt. I listen to you lots of times, and I love this bit. I lived in New Jersey for 8 years, lived right near where Aaron Burr lived in Hohokus, and find this extremely interesting. But I did not realize that Alexander Hamilton was one of the Sons of Liberty, because I thought they were all from Massachusetts.
No, I mean, there were Sons of Liberty in New York as well, and
oh, I didn't
probably
realize.
The reason that you don't associate Hamilton with it is it was one of the more radical organizations during the Revolutionary
Period.
Oh,
I know Samuel Adams was very involved, and
yeah.
He was very radical.
Yeah, and Hamilton had this more radical phase. He was an undergraduate. It's not surprising. He was completely, you know, caught up in the fervor of the early revolution, and the Sons of Liberty were very, very active in New York, as were the Tories.
Oh, I didn't realize it. Well, listen, I've learned some. I was a history major in college, and I lived in the East for 8 years and loved it. My husband used to say, oh, my God, we go to every historical place there is. I loved it, and I will get your book. Tell me your name again.
I'll tell you the name, ma'am. It's Ron Chernow. That's spelled Chernow.
Okay.
And the name of the book is simply Alexander Hamilton. And when you've read that, you can turn to the three or four other major biographies that Ron has done in the past. One of them is titled Titan, The Life of John D. Rockefeller Sr., which we discussed
we have done them all.
Oh, it sounds interesting. I love my favorite thing is reading biographies about famous people.
We did the House of Oregon together.
We did indeed.
Well, thank you very much.
We thank you so much for the call.
Okay, bye-bye.
And we will pause for a quick round of commercials and then directly back. 591-7200 is the number. And if you want to get to us via email, that's extension 720 at tribune.com. And we return to Ron Chernow and to our examination of some aspects of the wonderful life, the impressive life, the larger-than-life life lived by Alexander Hamilton, as recounted in this excellent new biography titled, quite directly, Alexander Hamilton. How did you resist subtitling it or giving it anything more of a play than just the name of the subject?
You know, I can't tell you how many dozens and dozens of titles I went through.
Uh-huh.
And each one seemed to omits some significant dimension of his life. So I finally, you know, the point of a title of a biography is to kind of draw readers in to get them to read the work. And I just figured this is self-explanatory. There is so much curiosity about Alexander Hamilton, the founding fathers. I didn't need to kind of trick it out in some kind of clever dress.
I think it's good self-discipline.
Yeah.
It's admirable. We go back to the phones. 591-7200. Good evening.
Good evening.
Yes, sir.
I had a question that I've never seen addressed. During the preparation for the bicentennial in 1976, the pistols used in the duel were brought out from the basement, I believe, of the bank and turned over to a gunsmith to be prepared or renewed or rejuvenated. And he discovered that they were hair-trigger pistols. Now, I've never heard this addressed. Now, in the duels of those days, as I recall, you would aim the pistol at the other person, put your finger on the trigger, and then raise it above his head and fire.
Mm-hmm.
Now, with a hair-trigger pistol, when you put your finger on the pistol trigger, it goes off.
Mm-hmm.
And Hamilton, I believe, fired first and came close to hitting Burr, tore some of his clothing or something.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right that during the bicentennial, some gun experts examined the famous pistols, you know, discovered the hair trigger. And for some of the Burr enthusiasts, they said, aha, there was a hair trigger, and this proves that Hamilton really, you know, went to the dueling ground intending to shoot Burr. In fact, it was a kind of unnecessary discovery in 1976 because it was already known to historians that at the dueling ground, Hamilton's second, Nathaniel Pendleton, said to Hamilton, should I set the hair trigger? And that Hamilton said, not this time. So this was actually in Nathaniel Pendleton's, you know, papers back from 1804. So this was the rediscovery of something. Hamilton was aware that there were hair triggers, and he asked that they not be set.
Our thanks to the caller. Let us go quickly to another. If you've been trying to get through, we've now got one or two lines cleared, so do try again. And if you move quickly, you may wind up on the board. 591-7200. And you are on the air. Good evening.
Good evening.
Yes,
I've heard a number of times before. I think I've read it in another book. I don't remember this exactly where I read it. But wasn't Aaron Burr rather harangued the rest of his life? Didn't this follow him the rest of his life? I seem to remember an anecdotal experience of him walking down the street and somebody actually crossing the street to call him a scoundrel and things for what he had done.
Well, because, you know, Hamilton was heroic among many Federalists in the North, the Federalists being his party, that Burr was denounced as a cold-blooded killer after the duel. In fact, dueling was illegal in New York and New Jersey, and Burr, even though he was vice president at the time, was indicted for murder in New York and New Jersey. He was, while on the lam from the law in New York and New Jersey, he went back to Washington, D.C., and he presided over an impeachment trial in the Senate of a Supreme Court justice. The reaction, I have to say, was very different in the South, where Hamilton was hated by the Jeffersonians. And I don't know if there was kind of, you know, outright cheering, but Burr spent time in the South after the duel until things cooled off. And in many places, he received a very friendly reception, so that the horror was far from universal.
Of course, later on, he further complicates his career by trying to establish a nation of his own.
Yeah, well, he was accused in 1807 of treason by Thomas Jefferson, who was not done with Aaron Burr, and accused Aaron Burr of trying to detach a portion of the Southwest and create his own empire. Burr, very much to Jefferson's dismay, was acquitted. And then Burr went to Europe, kind of rattled around Europe for 4 years, came back, lived for another 20-odd years in New York, a kind of a strange reclusive figure pointed out on the streets of New York. Is that notorious Aaron Burr? It's quite a life.
Well, you know, I just like to say real quickly, and then I'll get off the phone. A couple of summers ago, I read with a lot of pleasure David McCullough's John Adams, and I'm going to go out tomorrow and purchase your book for another great summer of reading.
Oh, wonderful.
And you will have great reading from it. We thank you, sir, for the call. And we will I'll go quickly to another on 591-7200. You are on the air. Good evening.
Good evening. Before I get to my intended question, one quick inquiry. Since Hamilton fathered 8 children, has that led to a recognizable and cohesive body of Hamilton descendants today, similar to the Adams family?
You know, it's very interesting that the descendants of the other founders, most notably the Jefferson descendants, there's a large Jefferson family association. I think that because of Monticello, it gives them a meeting place and a bond. I think that with the 200th anniversary of the duel coming up, and I think that my book has helped this process a little bit. All of these Hamilton descendants who were just scattered to the winds, there was no family organization. They didn't seem to know each other. For the first time, they're coming together. And to mark the 200th anniversary of the duel and of his death, there will be at least 30 direct descendants of Alexander Hamilton and their spouses coming to New York for graveside ceremonies for reenactment of the duel. So for me, it's a very pleasant association. If I've had any part in terms of helping to put all of these descendants for the first time in touch with each other.
Are they going to do a reenactment of the duel?
Of the duel.
Who's going to play the roles?
Well, there's an Aaron Burr Association that actually, there's a new Hamilton Association. The Aaron Burr Association, for some reason, is older and much more active, and it's nice that there's now an Alexander Hamilton Historical Society.
So we're going to have a descendant of each?
Yes, actually, descendants, yes, and also people involved with these Burr and Hamilton historical societies. Mm-hmm. So it will be interesting to see how these two sides get along on July 11th.
I imagine you will be there.
I'll be there. They were doing panel discussions,
sure.
But basically I'll be a spectator of the fireworks.
Thank you, sir, for the call.
What were Hamilton's positions on slavery, and did he own any slaves?
Hamilton, I document in the book, was the most consistent abolitionist among the founders, bar none. During the Revolution, he champions a plan to emancipate any slave who will pick up a musket for the Continental Army. After the war, he co-founds the first abolitionist society in New York. His record is spotless.
But back on St. Croix, his mother owned some slaves, did she?
Yeah. Actually, a lot of even poor whites in the Caribbean would own and rent out their slaves. So you're right. Hamilton's mother, I think, had 4 or 5 slaves plus their children. But the exposure to Caribbean slavery, which was the most horrific slavery in the world, average life expectancy 3 to 5 years once they arrived, left Hamilton clearly with a lasting detestation of the system.
Our thanks to the caller, and you are next on the air. Good evening.
Good evening.
Yes, sir.
Thank you very much for taking my call. Mr. Chernow, I read David McCullough's book on the life of John Adams and enjoyed it very much, but I was left with kind of a negative impression of Alexander Hamilton, and I thought that perhaps it might be delicate, but I thought perhaps you might just comment on that.
No, nothing delicate at all. You know, Hamilton and Adams engaged in a ferocious feud. It brought out the worst in both men. Adams felt that Hamilton secretly controlled his cabinet. Hamilton felt that he had been excluded from the inner circle of, or even the outer circle of John Adams's administration. And Adams felt that Hamilton had connived to deny him the presidency. Hamilton felt that Adams's very kind of, you know, temperamental behavior was very unpresidential. These two men really grated on each other. And so I think that David McCullough's book is absolutely wonderful. But if the only, you know, time you see Alexander Hamilton is in a biography of John Adams, he's not likely to show to advantage.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate that. Thank you. I'm very intrigued by your book. I've seen it in the stores, and I do plan to get it. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, sir, for the call. He really aspired to the presidency at one point, did he?
You know, he never received a single electoral vote, and given the custom at the time, you were not allowed to show ambition. You were not allowed to express any interest in the presidency. You had to pretend that your only interest in life was retiring to a farm and reading poetry all day. So I think that Hamilton's turn in the rotation hadn't come up. Remember, Washington was 23 years older than John Adams was 20 years older than Hamilton was. And so you can't find a single line where Hamilton says, I want to be president. You can't find a single thing that he did to promote it. But for somebody as ambitious as Hamilton, it is the one big prize that eludes him.
Wouldn't that have been constitutionally prohibited in that he was not a native-born American?
Interesting question. If you look closely at the Constitution, there's a clause that we no longer notice because it doesn't apply, and it's this. It says in the Constitution, you have to be 35, you have to be native-born to be president. It says, or else, a citizen of the United States at the time of the adoption of the Constitution who has been resident in the country for 14 years. Hamilton had been in the country for 15 years. In fact, some people think that he slipped in.
That he crafted it that way.
The loophole, although he was not in Philadelphia that particular week.
Curious question, and I've only got a minute left. It's on the email here, and it takes you back to another book. Can you comment quickly on the last iteration of J.P. Morgan and its merger with our hometown bank, Bank One?
Oh, I don't know. You know, J.P. Morgan is now part of Chase. Chase had been, you know, a merger of chemical and manufacturers. Hanover. There's so many different banks that are now fused together into what's called J.P. Morgan Chase that I find it very hard to find my old house of Morgan inside there. So I no longer consider myself expert on this new entity, which is a product of so many different bank mergers.
Do you ever imagine sitting all of the subjects of your biographies down at the same table to see how they might chat with one another? Rockefeller, the leading Warburg, Morgan, and now Alexander Hamilton.
I don't know, Milt, that would be the best party I'd ever been to. each of them was a prima donna.
Yeah.
And the fact, one of the charms of doing Hamilton was that he was so verbal. He was, as we say, so out there. And having written business biographies before, businessmen by nature are the most secretive human beings in the world, it was very nice to have Mr. Hamilton with his 22,000 pages of collected papers and opinions on everything under the sun, you know, after doing John D. Rockefeller, who was the most enigmatic man who ever lived. It was nice to have the showboating Mr. Hamilton for 5 years.
And it's very nice to have in hand this excellent new book, Alexander Hamilton by Ron Chernow. Has just recently been published. It's universally reviewed more than favorably, enthusiastically, and it is published by the Penguin Press and available wherever they sell real books.